I think there's a lot of people out there who are feeling a little beaten down more by the news itself than actually covering it. There's the general consensus of people is that there's a need for some hope that things are going to get better.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Dutch voters choose their youngest and first gay prime minister. A raid on an alleged gay wedding nets 25 in Nigeria. And queer journalists find silver linings in news clouds. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With NewsWrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 1st, 2025. Rob Yetton's Yes We Can campaign is set to make him the youngest ever and first out gay prime minister of the Netherlands. His socially progressive, economically centrist Democrat 66 party gained 17 seats in parliament, clobbering the far-right Party for Freedom. It's led by the man called the Dutch Trump, current PM Geert Wilders, whose party lost 11 seats. Sexuality did not play a major role in the 38-year-old's campaign. Instead, Yetten successfully expanded the voter base of the party, founded in 1966, by hammering Wilder for his divisive, anti-Muslim, and anti-immigrant policies. The October 29th election was also seen as a test of a slow swing to the right evidenced elsewhere in Europe. Yetten told English-speaking press on election night,
"This is an historic election result because we've shown not only to the Netherlands but also to the world that it is possible to beat populist and extreme right movements, and I'm very eager to cooperate with other parties to start an ambitious coalition as soon as possible."
Before a crowd of his cheering supporters, Yetten proclaimed,
"Miljoenen Nederlanders hebben vandaag de bladzijde.
Millions of Dutch people today turned a page and said farewell to the politics of negativity, of hate, of endless no we can't." To former Defense Minister Kajsa Ollengren, Yetten is without a doubt one of the most talented politicians the Netherlands has ever had, as she told The Independent.
25 people remain in the custody of Nigeria's Islamic religious police since the Hizbah arrested them at an alleged gay wedding on October 25th. The investigation in the northern city of Kano reportedly continues while the 18 men and 7 women each face up to 14 years in prison. The men were identified by the pre-Islamic term Yan Daudu, which refers to males exhibiting female traits. They're charged with violating laws that criminalize same-gender weddings and their promotion in the West African nation. Sheikh Mujahideen Aminuddin Abu Bakr is the Deputy Commander General Special Operations of the Hizbah Board. He said they acted on a tip from a concerned resident. He told 21st Century Chronicle that the board is committed to promoting a morally upright society and safeguarding the city's reputation as a community deeply rooted in discipline and Islamic values. Islamic law governs 12 of Nigeria's 36 states, all in the northern part of the country. That Sharia runs parallel to the state and federal criminal justice systems. Sharia punishes same-gender sex with the death penalty, although there are no records of an actual execution. Offenders in the south of the country face up to life in prison. Nigeria is considered one of the most anti-queer countries on the planet. Raids on so-called gay weddings began in 2007, according to Agence France-Presse. There was an 8-year lag, then they recurred every 3 to 4 years. The last was in 2022. There has never been a conviction.
Queensland's transgender youth sought access to their gender-affirming health care, appear under a Supreme Court ruling, and disappear again after just 6 hours. The Australian state's health director general, Dr. David Rosengren, had issued a ban on treatment for patients under the age of 18 that was challenged by the mother of a transgender child. Supreme Court Justice Peter Callahan decided that it was illegal because it was made without adequate consultation and at the direction of Health Minister Tim Nichols. He did not rule on its clinical appropriateness. In Callahan's words, the minister may give a service a direction if he's satisfied it is necessary to do so in the public interest. However, if the minister gives a direction, it must be in writing and published in a way that allows it to be accessed by members of the public. After the Supreme Court ruling, it only took Nichols 6 hours to be satisfied it was necessary in the public interest to deny puberty blockers and hormone therapies to new pediatric patients. He reassured Parliament that he had given written notice to Hospital and Health Services. He told them that the new directive would remain in place while an independent review of gender services is completed. That's expected by the end of November. The plaintiff is anonymous for legal reasons, but the trans child's mother is not backing away from the fight. She's vowing to do everything I can to see it overturned again. Politicians should not make decisions about medical care. I'm perfectly capable of doing that myself. The president of the Australian Medical Association, Queensland, agrees. Dr. Nick Yim told reporters that the denial of care causes real harm to pediatric patients. He said, "Treatment decisions must always be made by clinicians based on science, not ideological, political, or other clinically irrelevant beliefs."
Texas judges can refuse to officiate weddings of same-gender couples based on their sincerely held religious beliefs. This, according to an October 24th decision by the U.S. state's Supreme Court. The original Texas Code of Judicial Conduct specifically forbids judges from demonstrating bias or prejudice, including but not limited to bias or prejudice based upon race, sex, religion, national origin, disability, age, sexual orientation, or socioeconomic status. However, the all-Republican High Court concluded that justices of the peace who decline queer couples for religious reasons are not violating judicial ethics. McLennan County Justice of the Peace, Diane Hensley, refused same-gender couples while continuing to marry heterosexuals. The State Commission on Judicial Conduct found that her actions cast doubt on her ability to act impartially and publicly reprimanded her in 2019. For 6 years, Hensley has argued that the action was illegal because it punished her for adhering to her devout Christian beliefs. The Texas Supreme Court's decision amends Canon 4 of the state's judicial code. The justices wrote, "It is not a violation of these canons for a judge to publicly refrain from performing a wedding ceremony based upon a sincerely held religious belief." Texas State House LGBTQ Caucus Chair Jessica Gonzalez is disappointed but not surprised by the ruling. In her words, "Our right to marriage should never depend upon someone else's religious beliefs. This change in the Judicial Conduct Code will only further erode civil rights in Texas." The Texas case mirrors a federal lawsuit brought by Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis. She refused to issue marriage licenses to lesbian and gay couples soon after the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling in 2015. A decade later, the High Court is considering her challenge to that ruling. We may learn whether they will hear her appeal by November 10th, according to Pink News.
Finally, British King Charles III laid a bouquet of flowers near the first memorial to UK LGBTQ service members on October 28th, his first official engagement directly supporting the LGBTQ communities. The memorial honoring queer military veterans who served before the ban on their service was lifted is located at the National Memorial Arboretum near Lichfield, Staffordshire, England. As the royal family acknowledged in a social media post, throughout the 20th century, gay men, lesbians, and bisexual people were banned from serving in the UK armed forces. The ban on their service was finally lifted 25 years ago. The British government issued a formal apology to those who suffered under the ban in 2023. Queer veterans who suffered under the ban can apply for financial reparations of up to £70,000, about $93,000. The memorial is titled An Opened Letter, a bronze sculpture designed by the artist collective Abraxas Academy. It looks like a crumpled letter with specific words that were used in investigations of closeted queer service members. Words of hope and progress are concealed on the other side. The narrative on its British York stone base ends with a plea to embrace our diversity and fight for our country. The memorial's website calls it a place of reflection, recognition, and remembrance, ensuring that the stories of those who served and those who suffered are never forgotten.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending November 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay healthy.
And I'm Rhett. Stay safe.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out, the Gay and Lesbian International News Magazine.
Thank you.
That was without cue cards, people.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine.
And now it's time to set our dials back with the Rainbow Rewind, your look at the moments, milestones, and memories that shape our queer journey.
From hard-won victories to cultural firsts, from the unknown to the iconic legends,
we celebrate the people and events that remind us how far we've come and how far we still shine. I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Brian DeShazer. This week, we celebrate a few remarkable queer pioneers. Born November 3, 1952, comedian and writer Bob Smith became one of the first openly gay comedians to appear on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, breaking ground for LGBTQ humor in mainstream media.
Also born November 5, 1959, Bryan Adams, the Canadian rocker whose longstanding support for LGBTQ rights, including boycotts of anti-queer laws, earned him recognition as an ally in music and human rights circles.
Now let's rewind some key queer moments. On November 1st, 1992, the film The Crying Game premiered in the U.S., sparking international conversation about gender identity and representation.
And on November 4th, 2008, California voters passed Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriage, a heartbreaking setback that, after years of activism and court challenges, was ultimately overturned in 2013.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind.
Because our stories aren't just in the past, they're the pride that powers our future.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is just ahead.
To paraphrase their slogan, they're here, they're queer, they're on deadline. In the competition to control information, they're on a front line defending LGBTQ+ visibility. You know the work from the outside, but what's it like on the inside? I'm Brian DeShazer, and here's a peek behind the press badges.
I'm speaking with Ken Miguel, president of the Association of LGBTQ Journalists, or the NLGJA. Welcome to This Way Out, Ken.
Hello there.
Let's talk about the organization and its mission.
Sure. NLGJA's mission is to ensure fair and accurate coverage of the LGBTQ community. We're a nonprofit group made of professional journalists and professional media professionals from across the country and international, national, small, big markets everywhere.
Yeah. So here's quite an obvious question. How is the state of queer journalism today?
I think there's a lot of people out there who are feeling a little beaten down more by the news itself than actually covering it. There's the general consensus of people is that there's a need for some hope that things are going to get better. And we know historically speaking that they do whenever we have one of these times where our communities are attacked, but it's a lot for people to take on right now. Let's get the community as a whole and how we got where we are. You know, nothing's been without a fight. If we go back to the 50s or the 60s and look at, you know, what the Mattachine Society or the Daughters of Bilitis were doing in terms of trying to get attention for the communities, LGBT communities, mostly the lesbian and gay communities there. There was a lot of bar raids, animosity, protests were squashed, public gatherings were banned, people were meeting in people's homes, and we got past that. But it was journalists who were documenting that at that time that it really led to the rise of LGBT media in the late 50s, early 60s, and gave a platform for people to communicate with each other. Now, it's not until 1970s that we really start to see some of that getting mainstreamed, and really you don't see it completely seen as part of our community from a journalistic perspective until like Randy Schultz starts writing about AIDS for the San Francisco Chronicle in the early 80s. And actually, I was recently reading something that Randy had said of, you know, how he would go to work and, you know, it was an entirely different environment than what he was experiencing in his personal life, which he described as like going to a war zone. So, I think that's the challenge that a lot of us face now with going into our workplaces where predominantly the environments are heterosexual at best or at worst. And we have more people of our community, but we're not talking about the experiences and stuff because we're hearing so much about it when we're outside of work. So when you bring that perspective into work and try to report on it, you know, it is heavy and it's a lot to take in for people.
Let me ask you, does the NLGJA do a formal monitoring of this kind of thing, of how reporters or queer reporters are being either harassed or attacked or anything? Or is that come from another organization that might do that kind of statistics, like maybe GLAAD or Lambda Legal?
Yeah, GLAAD is an advocacy group, but GLAAD is their mission to look for coverage issues and, you know, call people out for them. NLGJA, we do have mechanisms in place with the Rapid Response Task Force that we have, which is a relatively small group of people who will respond to specific coverage. The New York Times, when there were issues about how the New York Times was covering trans people, politicizing them, we were, because we're professional journalists and because we have members in their newsroom, we were able to request a meeting with senior management at the New York Times, go in, sit down with them and say, here's what's fair, here's what's accurate, here's why words matter. This is where you're running into issues. You can say this, it's fair. Is it something that personally I might find offense in? Yes. But is it fair? Yes. Same thing recently with the Wall Street Journal. We had conversations with them about the Utah shooting and of Kirk, and the rapidness to identify a trans component to the killing when we still don't know if there is. And I won't get into all of the various conspiracy theories around that now, but you know, there's more reporting that can be done there. And even as a conservative organization like the Wall Street Journal is, they had an opportunity there to do some digging and research on a community that reads their paper and what the shooter might really be thinking. For example, the Wall Street Journal, one of the things I was telling them is like, the impact was beyond your newsroom. Everybody wants to be first to report something. You want to break that story. Saw the same bulletin that all the rest of us were seeing that identified this information that turned out not to be true of anti-trans ideology or trans ideology, whatever that is. And we actually were talking also with our friends at the Trans Journalist Organization, Transgender Journalist Association, about how they were receiving it. But the problem was when they reported that, they put every other newsroom that was trying to vet it in a really bad spot, because every other newsroom was then like, do we report it? Because it's such a politically charged issue. Do we have to report it because a conservative media outlet reported it? No, we haven't done our own independent reporting. Everybody was holding off and referring to the person as a shooter and reporting what we knew. That is where, you know, again, words matter, timing matters. When we actually put stuff out into public, it's not an impact just what the public is believing. And while one right or left side may be following it, it impacts all the other journalists covering the story too. It makes it look like if an LGBT journalist is covering a story, that they're hiding something because they chose not to publish that. When in reality, they hadn't confirmed it yet. There was no secondary confirmation on that. And we all know that police often get things wrong. We know that they put things out that often need to be corrected later. So you need to, everything needs to be sourced more now than ever, particularly when speaking of the community. Now, if we look at what the issues are that are being covered in the community now versus so if they were, say, 10 years ago, when I started, we were still having a debate over whether we'd call it in the early mid late 1990s, talking about sexual preference versus sexual orientation. And, you know, that lingered well into the aughts of in coverage of why, when to use that. Now, I think the same-sex marriage debate was another one where we really got into a time where people then started talking about preference and orientation again. But then they were also talking about same-sex marriage versus marriage and giving two different categories of things. So reality, we had to like reframe the terminology, not because it was political, but because it was fair and accurate to say marriage equality for same-sex couples or marriage equality, which really became the more commonly used one, though same-sex marriage still works its way into everything. The idea is by calling it same-sex marriage that it is somehow different than a heterosexual marriage. So it's a nuance of language and stuff. You know, once we got past the marriage debate with the national debate and marriage became, you know, rights became more secure, we get into trans issues. And so there's always somebody in our community that is being targeted for something. Problem with the trans coverage is so much of it is so wrong and so hyperinflated. I mean, when you look at like just even the issue of trans women in sports, you're dealing with it at the collegiate level, you're only dealing with 10 people out of hundreds of thousands of athletes, you know. So I know in our newsroom in here in San Francisco, and I know in other newsrooms, there really is an emphasis on like putting things into perspective. This impacts how many people. California recently had an issue with one trans athlete in a track and field tournament, invitational here in California, won. There were people calling on state to change the rules for how this person would be scored and judged. So there actually were two winners, a trans winner and a biological female winner as a compromise. But again, we were talking about one competitor. There was one person in that race. And in most cases, and my trans friends all tell me this, most trans athletes aren't very good, you know, and so it's not like they're going to do these things to be Olympic athletes. They're doing them for the same reason everybody else is, which is enjoyment, you know, the spirit of competitiveness, to stay healthy. You know, it's not, they're not out to fight a war on street people.
No, it's interesting. I guess what you're talking about, or what I understand you're talking about, are our style guides and the evolution of language and verbiage around the LGBTQ community to keep mainstream media on the straight and narrow is not the best term to use at this point.
But pun intended.
About how to report on LGBTQ issues. And I so appreciate that from your organization. Now, when we look at queer journalists that might be targeted or affected by, you know, retribution for a particular story, are there any mechanisms within your organization to help them legally, or do we just direct them to Lambda Legal or ACLU, or do you actually have relationships with those organizations?
I think actually, I have to say the media companies as a whole have been very good to their employees and in defending them and protecting them, to the point where I don't know of any significant issues that have come up. Even big companies that you wouldn't expect have stepped in to help their employee feel supported, stood by their reporting, and those people are still working, you know. So this is one of the issues that we have with this current administration. And I'm not, the tactic of this current administration has been to attack the media, and the media not great at defending itself, but it's been more focused on defending its record, making sure that we get things done fairly and accurately and are reporting facts as fact, undisputed facts. Whether people believe those or not is the challenge in this day and time, because there is so much misinformation out there. There are so many people who of authority who can say things that dispute those things, even though, or minimize those things, even though they can't be disputed. I can only speak specifically, well, I'm lucky, I can speak for both LGBT and non-LGBT journalists, but I, as the organization's president, I only speak for LGBT journalists when I say that I think we're doing a pretty good job of protecting ourselves.
Great. Thank you so much, Ken Miguel, for joining us at This Way Out. You can learn more about the Association of LGBTQ Journalists by visiting nlgja.org.
I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Rhett and Michael Taylor Gray and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written and produced by Sherry Lund and Brian DeShazer. Brian also produced the feature with the NLGJA's Ken Miguel. City Lauper and Garbage performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks David Hunt of Raleigh, North Carolina, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you can get your podcasts, and on WESU Middletown, Connecticut, CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.